From the Sky News Centre at 5, a United Nations official says at least 27 people have been killed after militants stormed a luxury hotel in Mali's capital. Gunmen took more than 130 people hostage at the Radisson Blue in Bamako, as Chris Giles reports.
Malian soldiers, backed by French and US special forces, were deployed to flush out around 10 gunmen who stormed the luxury hotel this morning. Militants entered the building, firing shots and shouting "God is great" in Arabic.
I heard the gunfire, but at first I didn't realise it was a hostage taking.
Some people managed to escape with help from the elite troops.
The military were very professional. They gained control of the whole floor. After that, they continued to go up again.
There are reports others were released after reciting verses of the Quran. An African jihadist group affiliated with Al-Qaeda claims it was behind the attack.
The European Union's external borders will have stricter controls following the Paris terror attacks. Plans are to be drawn up after the suspected mastermind got into France undetected. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says the change is crucial.
These controls will have to be carried out through an obligatory consultation of the national and European passes, the Schengen information system and the Interpol information systems, which contain crucial data with regard to international arrest warrants.
The police and crime commissioner Fasari's warned against cuts to police budgets. He claims officers and the public would be massacred if there was an attack outside of London. About two in three NHS trusts in England recorded budget deficits in the first 6 months of the financial year. Collectively, they were £1.6 billion in the red. That's the latest. I'm Annie Joyce.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Hi, my name is Sophie and I'm a Bristol Chris. It's just awesome. You're listening to BCFM on 93.2 FM.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Green Councillor for Easton, Anna McMullen. After the 6 o'clock news, a sophisticated attack in Paris killing 130 innocent Parisians a week ago. But with all the banking and surveillance power of the Western world, how are ISIS able to continue to finance their operations, both in the Middle East and now in Europe too? And if someone had told French intelligence after the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January how ISIS were being financed, don't you think they'd have wanted to know? And if they didn't, should they be held partly responsible for last Friday's carnage? Also, geopolitics, anomalies, exercises, fake passports, even a statement from the French police saying it was a sophisticated propaganda operation. But who's sophisticated enough to carry something like that out? And is there any precedent for terrorism across Europe with innocent people being shot dead in the streets in their hundreds? We look at NATO's Operation Gladio from the 1980s and 90s. Where hundreds of innocent Europeans were murdered to bamboozle European governments into following US foreign policy. Also, the news agenda. It must have been the refugees what done it. Really? And massive increases in MI5, GCHQ and SAS budgets, the British secret state, on the back of last Friday's attacks in Paris. As well as Cameron's moves to get a vote to bomb Syria, but ignore the UN Security Council. Is the Prime Minister trying to outdo Tony Blair as a war criminal? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of any other of the world's hotspots other than Paris too. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of three. Ooh, shivery. Cold, scattered showers and possibly windy too. This weekend, highs of around 7 Celsius. Cold weekend with some sun, scattered showers and a cold wind. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius, colder and sunnier at the beginning of the week, wetter towards the end of the week, a cold wind throughout. Next weekend, 28th and 29th of November, highs of 10 Celsius, warming up a little bit next weekend, cloudy with sunny spells and windy again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So I'm joined now by a Green councillor for Easton. That's Anna McMullen. Hi, Anna. Welcome to The Politics Show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
And your nice comfy chair in our lovely spanking new studio.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Tell us a bit about your background and why you decided to become a Green candidate rather than, you know, the Green Party rather than another party.
Well, I work for an organisation called Labour Behind the Label, which is an anti-sweatshop campaign. I'm a policy director. I see financial injustice in lots of places around the world. And I think that it's really vital that politics responds, that politics is able to step up and try to seek to redress the balance between the way that companies in the markets operate and the way that we deal with social change in our communities. And like, I've lived in Easton for the last 7-8 years. I love it. I think it's an amazing community and I want to support and represent it. The Green Party is a natural match for my values and views because it stands for people and planet and policies that make sure that we balance those two concerns.
Well, tell me about this Labour against Labour. What sort of things were you campaigning against? You know, what were you trying to stop that was going out in the outside world? And what's the connection with Bristol?
I mean, a whole load of stuff that we do is about wages for the people who make our clothes. So, you know, in factories around the world, in Bangladesh, in India, in Cambodia, workers are being paid, 30p a day to make our clothes. And that isn't enough to live on. When we look at the kind of gap between the minimum wage and the living wage that's available for the people who make those clothes, it's like double or even three times the amount. And so... But workers are having to make choices between, do I buy shoes for my children or do I get some more food in the larder, you know? And that's, those sort of choices shouldn't be having to be made. And like, and consumers who are shopping in Broadmead today also play a part in that sort of global value chain, and it's really important that we get active at all levels by getting governments to take action, getting companies to take action, and getting governments overseas to also intervene to sort out how do we deal with the problem of global capitalism.
Well, not having enough money to put food on the table for the kids or for yourself or anyone else. It seems to be globalisation is importing all the worst sort of things from abroad.
Oh, fully. Yeah, absolutely. And so how do we resist that, I guess, as a community? And I guess it's about how do we link up different parts of the supply chain so that women who are buying clothes in Broadmead also stand alongside the women who are making them in Cambodia and say, you and I are the same. You know, we together are able to resist this.
But I mean, aren't you sort of a bit of a Luddite, really? You're saying, well, actually, no, we don't want people buying, you know, big companies, Primark or whoever, buying stuff from other parts of the world. And actually what you're doing there is you're forcing wages even further down for people, say, in India, places like that.
I think we're not saying that companies should not be buying from those places, just that if they do buy from them, they have a responsibility to ensure decent work. They have a responsibility to ensure that those jobs and services that are
But they'll say they won't. They don't have any responsibility. The only responsibility they have is to make money for their shareholders.
So we do have international human rights law, which says that companies have a responsibility to ensure that the wages that they pay are enough to ensure a decent standard of living. So it's also not just about those jobs over there, but also about jobs over here. So people working in Primark in Broadmead probably aren't earning enough to be able to be able to support a family, and so like it's solidarity with those people as well is what Labour Behind the Label stands for.
Well, what's your experience been like in the first, what is it, 8 months or so as a councillor, 6-8 months as a councillor?
Yeah, it's been an interesting ride. It's been a privilege to be able to serve the people of Easton. You get invited into people's homes and told about their stories and the issues that they face within our city, and trying to represent them and stand up for them in a local government that increasingly is suffering from national cuts to welfare, to services. You know, that's a struggle, and it's difficult to do that every day.
Committees, you're on committees. How have you actually got engaged? Have you actually made a difference as a councillor? Because I thought George was sort of, isn't he Lord Ferguson? Doesn't he just rule the entire planet around
he
here?
He certainly is, and he does. And It's interesting trying to be within that democratic setup where more and more local councillors are having power taken away from them and are not really able to have a big say over what really happens in the affairs of the city.
Sounds like you're doing yourself out of a job. You're saying, well, there's actually not much point in voting for me, really.
There is point in voting for us because the Greens are looking at ways that we can revolutionise the way that we'll do the mayoral system. I mean, currently George has made decisions about the way that he's going to manage that power, and I think the Greens would do that in a different way, trying to give power back to local communities.
So I notice in the news this week we hear that there is going to be an opportunity to have another referendum to see if we like the mayor system and to go back to the old system if we like it. What part of the Green Party played in that, getting that around? Because that's been maybe mainly a Lib Dem initiative, hasn't it?
Yeah, we fully welcome that, and I think it's brilliant that Barbara Jank's been kind of pushing that on a national level, and has managed to get some traction. I think we would campaign strongly to get rid of the mayoral system if possible.
So what do you think would be, just in a nutshell, what's the main differences between the committee system, the old system where councillors collectively effectively run, party, obviously one major party will be deciding on who's the council leader, who is part of the cabinet, etc. What's the main difference between the way George is running things, George Ferguson now, and that system? Which side, why do you come down more in favour of going back to the other system?
I think we have a democratic deficit. We get situations whereby full council has a meeting where 70 people come, everybody votes, we put through a motion saying let's not sell off the port, a vital Bristol asset, and then George, and the recommendation is that the mayor should take our views on board, and then he's able to say actually no, we're going to sell it anyway, and so how is that democracy?
Well, it's not democracy,
and so we're in a situation where the city has elected 70 councillors who are not able to speak on behalf of the people who have elected them, and so this autocracy is not working, and I think it's too much power to put into the hands of one person to be able to override the views of the city.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, some people have talked about it as a dictatorship where you elect 70 councillors to have a bit of maybe forced multiplication, at least with lots and lots of minds scrutinising things, and actually the only person that's really making the decision at the end of the day is one, and that's George.
Well, and George's mandate is very weak. If you actually look at the turnout in a referendum to decide to have a mayor, it was very, very small, less than 20% of the electorate, and the turnout in the actual election was very small, and he got about half of that. That is not really a mandate for total power. And I'm of the traditional view that we should have parliamentary government, if you like. A committee should run things. It shouldn't be in the hands of one person. And if you think back to the GLC in the 1980s when Ken Livingstone used to run it, he said at the time, I don't want to be a mayor, elected mayor. I want to be the head of a democratic council. And I think that is generally the view of those of democratic persuasion in the Labour Party.
I mean, I know if George were here, he'd say, well, in the past, Bristol's been riven with these ridiculous party political point scoring and nothing ever gets done.
But I think it's gone too far the other way. We've gone to a situation where we've ignored the value that I think that the many councillors and the expertise and the scrutiny that over the decisions that are being made by our city, that value that is bought by all of our councillors. And so just to say, oh, well, party political point scoring has no place, I think is to ignore the fact that that sometimes in the back and forth of argument, you improve a decision, you make it better, you ensure that the views of the people around the city are heard. So
I know also this week there's been, I don't know if it's you or others in the Green Party getting involved a bit with squatting, and I think, is it Devon Road? I'm not sure exactly whereabouts, but just tell us a bit about that, because this is something I care a lot about. I know if people are made homeless, they're almost expected, it seems, to go and sleep on the streets. There's all sorts of reasons people could be made homeless, but actually I rather like the whole attitude of people who say, well, I'm not going to sleep on the streets, there's so many empty buildings in the city, I'm going to find somewhere at least out of the wind, out of the cold, especially in the winter, that I can spend the night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this was in the heart of my ward in Easton. There's a building at the end of Devon Road, corner of Whitehall Road, which is actually owned by the Ministry of Justice. And a bunch of great people decided that they were going to live in that building, were going to open it up and try and bring in people from the local community to have a vision for what could that space be like? How could we use the land that is vacant in the middle of our
society? Hang on, why are you saying these great people? Other people living around there might not want the squatters to move in.
Well, that's true, but maybe they wouldn't want a big empty building.
Things like late night parties.
They were not the type of people who were having late night raves. They were trying to encourage a vision for the community, and unfortunately, what happened was they were taken to court and they were evicted by the bailiffs in the middle of the night. But I mean, I think it.
Hang on. Eviction in the middle of the night. That doesn't sound right. I mean, certainly the way these things are normally done is if the owners get in this case, the Ministry of inverted commas justice, get a possession order, they would give them something like 2 weeks to get out, and then they come and evict them one morning in the daytime. What are they doing evicting people in the middle of the night? Is this just because the bailiffs get double time?
Who knows? But it's horrific and really disrespectful, I think, of the type of value they were trying to bring to that building and the way that they were trying to engage with the local community.
Well, this is the first I've ever heard of midnight evictions. This sounds pretty scary, Martin, actually.
Well, it is. And of course, the coalition government stopped all squatting in residential properties. And I used to squat in London in the 1980s, and many of the squats that I used to squat in became housing cooperatives and gradually became part of housing people who would otherwise not have got on the housing ladder.
I suppose the problem here, Anna, is that you've got squatting almost potentially with the situation we've got now with increasing numbers of homeless, nearly a million right across the country now, and also lots and lots of empty buildings. You've almost got, it would almost be like a growth industry, squatting, if it was allowed to carry on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, homelessness is a growing issue within Bristol. You know, we look at the Bear Pit and there's lots of people sleeping out, that, you know, and maybe this is as a result of a much bigger problem in the city about rising house prices, about the way that the private rental sector is going, and the way that the property market is ousting people from our inner city areas.
I suppose it's a bit like squatting being a kind of relief valve for the government failing to deal with it. But how would you deal with it? How would the Green Party deal with the homelessness problem?
I mean, I think if we look to the example of Manchester and Liverpool, who have taken on board the issue of homelessness, have said, okay, we have lots of empty buildings, let's identify them, let's open them up, let's house homeless people within them over the winter. I think that you know, within a frame of this is for this amount of time and this is what the clear offer is a very feasible thing that Bristol should be doing, should be really stepping up to that example.
Sounds like common sense to me. I mean, if the City Council has got a vast portfolio, in fact, I remember reading a couple of years ago that Bristol has got as a proportion of the land, it's got more property than any other council in the entire country, that some of that property, whether it just be land or buildings, empty buildings, should be used for squatters. It sounds like common sense to me, or hope for housing the homeless.
Well, Bristol is really property rich. It's interesting in that way. And there's been a petition this week where 6,000 signatures have been gathered to call on Bristol City Council to use the empty properties in our area to house homeless people. And I hope fully that I'm supporting it, and I'm trying to push that within the council to see whether we can realise
that. That's right. I mean, Manchester has decided to do it, haven't they? They've found various buildings that they're not using. They've put. Why can't Bristol do that? Why haven't we done it?
Inertia.
George. Ask George. George. Yeah, ask
Let's
George.
Ask George. Hey. Yeah.
Ask the Lord of the Manor. He'll tell you. Martin, seriously though, how do we get out of this fix? I mean, we also heard today. I know, noticed in the news just in the last couple of hours, the government borrowing is the worst October figure in 6 years. This is shows in a way, in a very very clear way, that the economic policy austerity is simply not working. Public sector net borrowing rose 1.1 billion. Pounds. I'll say that again, folks, £1.1 billion up in October compared with the same month a year ago.
Well, you're conflating two related topics. One is housing and the other is the macroeconomy. I mean, basically, the austerity policies that have been pursued in Britain for the last few years have not worked. And ultimately, there's going to have to be a change of direction. I think the fact that they're losing control of public borrowing shows that in actual fact they don't really understand what they're doing. You've got to, and the other point that it really needs making is when the crash happened in 2008, and I know you don't like calling it a crash, Tony, but it led to a substantial fall.
Well, it was a bailout.
Yeah, all right, but it led to a substantial fall in economic activity, not as much as might have happened if there hadn't been a bailout. But the fact is that a modern welfare state, as we used to have in this country, is designed to deal with shocks like that. So as a boom takes hold and property prices rise and incomes rise, if you've got a progressive tax system and you've got like what we used to have, the rating system, that starts to suck demand out of the economy to prevent inflation. And then when you hit a crash, because people are paying less in taxes, less in rates as it used to be, and more money is paid out as unemployment benefits, housing benefits and so on, that cushions the economy against a shock. So you would expect to see a rise in public borrowing in a crash, and you want to see a rise in public borrowing in a crash. I'm making this point because a lot of people don't seem to realise that a rise in public borrowing in those circumstances is not necessarily a bad thing, but a rise in public borrowing to bail out the private sector financial industry is another matter entirely. I would have argued that you should have bailed out the people, but that the banks should have been allowed to go bust, and that would have led to a complete reorientation of the balance between the public and the private sector in the
economy. Martin, looking at the Mansion House speech by David Cameron on Monday night, he does an annual speech to the City of London there. I was thinking, well, these are the people that really run the country, aren't they? And nobody elects them.
Well, indeed. And of course, what should have happened, according to the free market textbook, when banks become insolvent, they should be allowed to go bust. And I would argue this, I mean, we've got a thing about Iceland here later. That's exactly what they did. They allowed, they'd never had a private banking system before. They'd basically had a state-run banking system until 2003. They privatised it. They immediately then went bust. But they allowed them to go bust, but they bailed out, they increased unemployment benefit, for example. So the banks are allowed to go bust, but we increase unemployment benefit. That's the rational policy. What we've done is we've bailed the banks out as a means of trying to preserve the real economy, and that's the wrong way round. And, of course, this was a cross-partisan point of view. I mean,
Martin, he said he was saving the world. Gordon Brown did this.
Well, exactly. I mean, and the point is that we were then put in a position where, because we'd had no reform of financial services over the last 15 years, we then bailed the banks out, and that was regarded as some kind of radical measure, when, of course, it really was the scraping the bottom of the barrel.
But to come back to this idea that the Tories don't know what they're doing, which is something I think we'll agree on, it was really interesting, that story last week where David Cameron had to wrote to the leader of Oxford Council to say, hey, why are you cutting all these services? Why is this really damaging our local city? And the leader of Oxford Council wrote back saying, we've cut everything that we can cut. This is now impacting on real people and on real communities. And it's this mismatch where with one hand the Tory government seems to be thinking austerity is totally fine and there's loads of savings that local authorities can make, and then with the other hand being shocked when actually their policies are really being played out in practice, and they just don't seem to see the cause and effect of what they're doing.
Apparently, George Osborne will need to restrict borrowing to just £15 billion between now and April. That's what this BBC story is saying about the worst borrowing figure for 6 years. Martin, if you were sitting in Osborne's chair, how would you turn things around in the next 6 months?
Well, the first thing I wouldn't do is to set...
I don't want to hear what you wouldn't do, because that's what he's probably going to do. What would you do?
They've set in stone the idea that they've got to balance the books.
What would you do?
Well, the first thing you've got to do is educate people to realise that a certain amount of government borrowing...
Okay, once you've done that, what would you actually do? Would you spend the money? Where would you get it from?
Well, what should be happening...
Because the banks might say, we're not lending you anything.
Well, what you should have is an orderly bankruptcy of most of the leading financial institutions.
How can that be orderly? It's going to be chaotic.
No. It's not going to be orderly. There is going to be a crash. That's what's going to happen, as Vince Cable points out in another article that we're looking
at. So how would you do that in an orderly fashion?
Well, we can't now. It's too late. So there is no orderly fashion. There's going to be a crash. And when that crash happens, the moaning about what's happened in Oxfordshire City Council, County Council will just be a straw in the wind.
Okay, I'll ask you then, Anna. What, you know, if you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes, you're not, but if you were, what would be your priorities? What would you be up to?
I'd cut Trident, which is the golden ticket.
Yes.
We'd save loads of money. I'd regulate the banks. I think we need to divide casino banking from high street banking to make sure that those two disciplines are very separate. And I'd ensure that we have charges on banking that then feed back into the public sector. I'd look at a wealth tax to see a tax on the top 1% to make sure that we redistribute wealth within our economy. And I'd look at investing in infrastructure to create jobs and to build the circular economy within a number of different parts of Bristol.
Well, there you go, George. George Osborne, not George Ferguson. George Osborne, Anna's got a little plan there. I think you should have a listen, because if you don't, it looks like we're going to be in even deeper trouble by the end of the year. Anyway, let's have a look at another story now, and that is to do with the St Paul's Carnival. I noticed that it's Marvin Rees, as that's the Labour candidate for mayor, has waded in here, saying it's part of Bristol's heritage and it should be saved. Anna, what do you make of this debacle? The nasty kind of background to this is George Ferguson, as an ex-merchant venturer, is basically saying to the existing Afro-Caribbean committee that runs the carnival, or has been trying to run the carnival, he's not going to fund them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think Marvin's really right to wade in on this. I think it's vital that we preserve the cultural heritage of our city. So, I mean, the African Caribbean community has a big place within St Paul's, and it's right that we should try and celebrate their community and what they do once a year. And I think that's brilliant. And the carnival is loads of fun. But I think we do have to look at what has happened in previous years. So, I mean, last year there were 6 stabbings. There was huge problems with litter, the way that the area was left, and the carnival was not a safe event. And I think that there's actually been quite a lack of communication between the festival organisers and the council, and we haven't had clear reassurances on how can the carnival be made into a really safe event that's welcoming for everybody, where we don't have crime, basically.
Well, earlier this week, as a part of a recording for the podcast, the Dialect programme, which used to go out here on BCFM up until recently, we're hoping it's going to be going out again soon, I spoke to Jules Davis, and he's a former artistic director of St Paul's Carnival, about the whole event. What he makes of it?
Within the carnival's current articles, it must stay free, but that's in the current articles. Now, what goes forward in the future, that might be looked at. Mm. That might be... Look, can I just raise a really important issue? 100,000 people attend St Paul's Carnival. They raise £5,000, and that's a good carnival by raising £5,000.
This is bucket shaking, yeah?
Bucket through bucket shaking, that's personal donations. In reality, that's 20p per head. But let's flip the script there, Tony, because at the same time, it's resourced by the authorities to the tune of £147,000.
Well, that's not too much, is it, out of our council tax?
That's £1.47. You mentioned it yourself. That's £1.47 per head. Now, is that really enough to put on an artistically excellent, internationally renowned event that's safe?
Should it be a profit-making event? Or should it be paid for by the city council out of our council tax?
What I think is that a 100,000 people come, they spend £66 per head. That's nearly £7 million that's coming into Erin that day. And I say we do need to be able to monetize enough so that you can draw down enough money that goes back into the carnival itself so that it's self-sustaining. We have to be realistic. You know, 40% cuts are on their way. You know, if you're a weak-looking organisation, you're going to get your head chopped off. St Paul's Carnival falls into that because it's a high-profile event that's a black-led organisation which is dysfunctional. That's the reputation that it has. It's infighting and outfighting. It's a problem every year. There's health and safety issues. People are getting stabbed. That's how the media plays it, you know. But just to say, going back to your thoughts around George Ferguson, is what he's specifically said is that he has ring-fenced the money for an African Caribbean-led event, and that's what people, the community, must hold him and the authorities to. They have said they are committed to St. Paul's Carnival. They've just taken the money away from St. Paul's African Caribbean Limited.
That was Jules Davis, their former creative director of St. Paul's Carnival. Martin, what do you make of this? It sounds like possibly becoming a paid-for event.
Well, I think that would be a shame if it was, because it's the inclusivity of it which makes it such a successful event. And as they point out, 100,000 people turn up. Now, of course, six stabbings are very, very regrettable. And as always, a tiny minority of people are spoiling it for the other 999,000 people who've turned up. I think it's got to be, we've got to sustain it somehow or other. I think it's, you know, if we're going to have things like the Harbour Festival and so on, and the Food Festival and all the rest of it, so the St. Paul's Carnival attracts a much wider cross-section of the population than even those big events.
But the Harbour Festival's free, isn't it? I mean, at least, I mean, there are paid-for parts of it,
indeed,
but basically the whole thing's free. So
indeed.
why should St. Paul's Carnival be paid for?
Well, I tend to agree, and I think the fact is that policing is policing and needs to be, it's a separate thing.
See,
I mean, if you're going to have a large crowd of people there, the potential for some people to behave badly and carry out crimes is going to be there. But I mean, in general, when I've attended the event, it's generally been a good-natured event. But of course, inevitably, and often you get people coming in from outside frequently who've got a different agenda.
Okay,
and the police have to deal with that.
On to another story. And Ian Duncan Smith's tougher fit to work tests coincide with 590 additional suicides. Academic researchers also find 279,000 cases of mental ill health, 725,000 more prescriptions for antidepressants. This is Charlie Cooper in The Independent. The findings have been disputed by the Department for Work and Pensions. Now, the introduction of tougher fit-to-work tests, Anna, for sick and disabled people have coincided with hundreds more suicides and thousands more cases of mental illness. That's according to these academic researchers.
It's really sickening. I'm horrified, really, at what's happening with the way that this government is, laying into people who are out of work, people who are sick, people who are disabled, and are taking away their benefits, and the natural repercussions are what we're seeing right now, you know. And local authorities like Bristol have really got some way to go to think about how do we respond to these horrific policies that are coming from central government. How do we make sure that we protect the most vulnerable within our city and offer them services and support so that that we don't have these stories come.
Martin, a lot of this apparently is between 2010 and 2013, which is when they've done this survey, to do with the introduction of the work capability assessments.
Well, as I understand, large numbers of those work capability assessments were not carried out professionally and were overturned on appeal. I don't think there's any case for anybody other than a qualified doctor to decide whether people are fit or not fit for work. So having, you know, half-trained ATOS personnel deciding whether people are fit for work is a travesty. And in any case, I also ask the question, who is going to employ all of these people that they seem to think will benefit from being made to work? In Cuba, they have a full employment policy, and every business, whether it's Bristol City Council or any other business, has to take a certain proportion of people who are mentally ill, who are got alcohol and drug problems, who are, you know, whatever, and they're all made to work. But that means that hits the profit bottom line of all of those organisations. But in Cuba, a full employment communist society, everybody can be made to work. In Britain, who is going to employ these people?
Anna, we're talking here about 590 people who are no longer with us.
Yeah, there's not much more to be said about it. It's just horrible.
And the amount of money saved is trivial compared to the amount of money we're chucking down the drain on Trident, nuclear power, peaceful nuclear power, supposedly, wars abroad, bailing out banks. It's vindictive. It's class warfare from the top.
Okay, another story. And this week has been a vote overwhelmingly by junior doctors to go on strike. This was something which was brought up this week at Prime Minister's Questions by, I'm not quite sure the name of the MP, I think it's Julie Siddiqui. So let's go back to Wednesday to the House of Commons to have a listen to that now.
Tulip Sadiq.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituent was a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan and is currently training to be a doctor in London. He told me that with the proposed junior doctor's contracts, morale in the NHS is lower now than at any point during his time on the front line. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that low morale amongst our junior doctors and nurses is a threat to patient safety?
Well, what I'd say to the Honourable Lady's constituency and indeed to all junior doctors is please look very carefully at what the government is offering before you decide to go on strike. Because what is on offer is not an increase in hours. Indeed, for many doctors, it will mean less long hours. It's not a cut in the pay bill for junior doctors. It's actually an 11% basic pay increase. It'll mean a better rostering of doctors, including at weekends, with more support for consultants. And I'd say to her constituent, as I'd say to others, go on the Department of Health website, look at the pay calculator and see how you will be affected, because we've given a guarantee that anyone working legal hours will not be worse off under this contract. This is good for the NHS, good for doctors, good for patients, and even at this late hour, I hope the BMA will call off their damaging strike.
Yeah, so there we hear David Cameron, a marketing man, making a sleight of hand, which is trying to hide the fact that junior doctors are being asked to do to have their hours increased from 48 to 56 hours a week. And, you know, like it's terrible that we're not supporting these vital people within our NHS. And people say that it's irresponsible that they're going on strike, but I think it's irresponsible for them not to. I think it's vital that our doctors are paid enough, have enough rest, and are to enable them to do their jobs well and to look after people within our hospitals, because the vital function that they provide for our country needs to be protected. And those jobs have to provide them that.
Well, it's another example of the government's complete defiance of professional opinion, whether it's in the health service, in teaching, or in the police or the law. They have become the enemies of professional people, and I think hopefully in the long run they will reap the political benefits thereof.
Okay, Martin, rather pedestrian approach there. But and also, just to add to this, today we've heard the National Health Service deficit, maybe you can get animated about this, Martin, has soared to £1.6 billion. The NHS, this is in The Guardian, literally a couple of hours ago, the NHS's deficit in England soared to £1.6 billion in the first half of this year, almost double the £930 million overspend it recorded in the first 3 months. New official figures revealed services finances sank even further into the red over the summer as hospitals had to hire extra staff to maintain quality of care and deal with both rising demand from patients and large numbers of patients who could not be discharged from the hospital because of inadequate social care. That was £358 million worse than expected, and was partly because hospitals' increasing difficulty in recruiting enough staff forced them to spend £900 million more than planned on agency staff. The grim picture, unprecedented in the NHS's history, is detailed in the latest data on NHS financial performance just published by Monitor and the NHS Trust Development Authority, bodies which oversee NHS foundation trusts and non-foundation trusts respectively. So this is a pretty frightening situation, isn't it? 1.6 billion in the first half of the year, Martin.
Well, it's all to do with the marketisation of healthcare. So you've got health trusts who are basically stuck in the situation of trying to balance books, which never used to be the case.
No. What they're saying here is that by the end of the year, £2.2 billion in deficit. The NHS is badly in the red and going down fast.
I mean, I think this is part of the long-term policy of the Tories. I think what they're playing the long game, trying to undermine the way that the NHS is functioning consecutive cuts to the way that's working in order to make the case for the privatisation of healthcare over time. And as more and more these policies add up, at some point they're going to point to that deficit and say, oh look, you know, if we privatise this, we could pay for that. And that's and that's where this is going. They're playing a long game.
Again, looking at the money, Martin mentioned it briefly earlier, but Iceland has jailed 26 bankers. Why won't we? This is Ian Birrell, an excellent article in The Independent, saying, yes, fines totalling £150 billion have been imposed on the 20 biggest banks in Britain for transgressions such as market manipulation, money laundering, mis-selling mortgages. I would add to that interest rate swaps, also, of course, LIBOR, foreign exchange. These costs fall on shareholders. Yes, shareholders. And by hampering the bank's ability to lend the wider community while the perpetrators carry on collecting their obscene bonuses, Martin.
Well, I mean, this is what should have happened. Peter Galbraith, who is the son of the US economist John Kenneth Galbraith, he's in Texas, University of Texas. He has basically been pushing for several years for the prosecution and of course you can then seize the assets of people who are prosecuted.
So this is the big question, isn't it? Why has it happened over in Reykjavik, little Reykjavik, which apparently is about the same sort of population as the greater Bristol area?
Well, you've answered
Iceland. Why is it happening there and not here?
Well, you've answered your own question. In Iceland, people can actually see because of the smallness of the community, they can see exactly who's responsible. They can point the finger at them and say they're to blame, and they can put them in prison and take their assets. What's happened? Don't forget that the city of London doesn't just provide money supply, as it were, to the British economy. It provides money supply to the rest of the world. And if we are basically bailing out the international financial system, the Icelanders were not, and we have. You know, if you don't, what should have happened when we had the crash in 2008? We had a Labour government. Once you've agreed to bail out the banks, you've got to completely reform the setup. Okay. They didn't do that.
Anna, on Iceland, but I mean, also with this week, we've had the HBOS report from all those years ago, the collapse of HBOS. It's one of the things that didn't help, certainly with the financial crisis and the bailout in 2008. But the interesting thing about HBOS, I thought, was that they were having a go at the directors of those banks rather than the executives. Now, what was happening was the executives were doing all these dodgy deals behind the scenes, and they were burying them amongst papers, and they were making sure the auditors didn't see them, that sort of thing. So why would you focus on the directors of the bank who haven't managed to discover what the executive are up to? And the very worst that seems to be that it might be happening to those HBOS directors is that they might be told, oh dear, you won't be able to serve as a director anymore. But nothing at all is being done to these bank executives.
I mean, I think this just highlights the need for transparency within the financial sector. You know, we've got this situation where banks who increasingly make decisions about the way in which our built environments develop, or you know, the big money within our country has more and more power, and we don't have a system for ensuring that those executives have any democratic oversight. You know, the big bosses of the banks end up being the ones who take all the blame, but that's because, you know, shareholder action is non-existent. You know, how do we regulate that the power of big money? And I think the way that we have to do it is we need to break up the big banks. We can't have all these big banks making huge decisions on behalf of our country. We need lots of smaller banks, and we need to try to ensure that the market encourages
now,
that.
I might be bonkers, but I think of banking as a utility, a bit like electricity or water, you know, something that we need to work. We don't want people in there using it against us to make loads of money for shareholders and profit making.
Well, I think this is possibly one of the first things that we might have a disagreement about, because I'm a socialist, and I actually believe that we should have a nationalised banking system, and that in actual fact, competition is not the answer to everything.
One of the things that nationalisation does is it opens up the books much more.
Well, indeed, and also what the banks actually do is create the money supply. It's not the government that creates the money supply, it's the banks. And that actually shouldn't be in the private sector.
Well, there's an article,
it should be a public function to create the money supply.
There's an article in the, again, Ben Chu, fantastic Ben Chu, follow him on Twitter, brilliant guy, just written a Stoke. Terrific book as well about the city. Vince Cable, former business secretary, warns that severe economic storms are on the way. I thought you'd like this one, Martin. Just up, right up your street. Sir Vince Cable, his honourableness, the former business secretary and the only senior politician who sounded the alarm about fragility of the UK economy in advance of 2007. It's actually apart from Martin Summers here, of course. Although Martin is not a senior, not a senior politician, but he certainly was making a fuss about it beforehand, has warned of another looming reality check for Britain. Writing exclusively for The Independent, Sir Vince, who dramatically lost his Twickenham parliamentary seat at the May general election, argues UK's economic recovery is precarious and unbalanced, and a reckoning is coming. Dismissing the cheery self-confidence of George Osborne and other ministers, Sir Vince points to the UK's still elevated levels of household debt, double-digit home price inflation, and growing risk of a financial earthquake emanating from China as reasons for serious concerns. Martin, maybe Anna first on this, actually.
I don't know what to say. I agree. I think
he's
the severe economic. Sorry,
he's talking about an earthquake. It sounds, you know, this is the sort of thing that nearly happened in 2008, and now it seems it's on the horizon again.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been the successive governments have been economically naive to think that we can keep building a debt bubble and that. You know, we failed to respond properly to the 2008 crash. So we haven't put in place those regulations on borrowing and the financial sector that were needed in order to ensure that it didn't happen to us again. And we've bowed to the power of the city, of the banking industry, who have said no, we won't mess it up again next time, and it's coming, you know. I think Vince Cable is right to highlight it.
So Martin, would you put your arm around Vince and say, couldn't agree more, mate?
Well, basically, I think all serious observers of the situation realise that Britain is particularly vulnerable, but the global economy, of which Britain is a key part, is actually in a very dangerous state. The Baltic Dry Index, which basically measures the cost of buying a ship to transport stuff from A to B, has fallen through the floor in the last 3 months, and the stock markets have reached new highs on the understanding that they're going to get loads more free money from the central banks. That is actually a perfect storm in essence. I think there is going to be a mega crash sometime relatively soon, and it's not a question of reforming anything anymore. It's too late. When we get to the other side of that crash, we're going to have things like emergency wealth taxes on the wealthy, because of course the allocation of resources by the market, once you've bailed out the financial services sector, is no longer a market allocation of resources. Because the central banks, we've had zero interest rates and quantitative easing, the profits that have been made throughout that period are not real profits.
So do you think the rich do you honestly think the rich and powerful are going to allow that?
No, they're not. They're going to try and kill us all and stop it. Because in many countries, it's very clear what will happen. There will be civil wars. The wealthy in Venezuela will refuse to pay up, and they will try and kill their way out. And other people will have to try and kill them to get the money off them. This isn't very green. It's rather bloody red.
So you're seriously suggesting civil war here in Britain?
Not necessarily, but I'm just pointing out that that is the reality in many countries in the world. That's what we failed to do in the last 5 years.
But I mean,
what we've done in the last 5 years is we've printed money, we've had a zero interest rate policy, which has pushed up the biggest debt bubble in history. It will burst, and it will burst at the same time as major geopolitical fault lines are emerging between Russia, China and the Western powers. The likelihood is that this is not going to end well, and it's certainly not going to end with a chorus of kumbaya.
And is there going to be, do you think, any real chance to get some kind of economic justice out of that kind of catastrophic crash at the end of the day?
Well, I mean, in the 19th century, socialists used to believe that this kind of cataclysm would lead to a positive outcome. I've got no such belief. But on the other hand, we've, like any kind of warfare, you have to fight to win because there's nothing else to do.
But the thing is, I mean, economically, the poor or most ordinary people working, you know, driving home out there, have got very, very little clout, simply because they're either struggling to make ends meet in the first place, or they've just got no money at all.
Well, that's right, but that's why that's why the results will have to be through political action rather than, for example, strikes and so on. You can only go on strike if you've got a job. But I think the political pressure is rising all over the world. And people are ultimately going to say, we demand a basic standard of living from the society we live in, with all of its resources, with all of the technologies we've got. We demand a basic standard of living. If we don't get it, we are going to fight back until we do get it.
Well, I mean, there's quite a lot of people out there, Anna, who have got absolutely nothing, being even not able to claim benefits, being sanctioned for many months, simply not even enough money to buy loo paper, for God's sake. So what do we do about people who have got absolutely nothing? What can we do for them?
I mean, I think this is why I believe in the welfare state. I believe that we need to have a system where we redistribute wealth between the most wealthy and the least wealthy, so that we look after our own, we look after everybody who lives here, and so we have to ensure that we protect the welfare state in the wake of the financial crash, and also that we build resilience within our cities. I mean, I think what we are doing is looking at how can we have systems within our city so that when bad things happen, be it environmental, be it economic, that we've got safety nets to protect people, and I think more and more modern cities are going to have to build to that and not be so dependent on Westminster.
I mean, it's really about dignity. I mean, surely as a civilised society we can make sure everybody has the bare minimum. I'm sure we can. Anyway, another story. The great smart meter rip-off. Energy giants will use devices to double the cost of power when you need it most. Well, you thought a smart meter was smart. Think again. I think it was Money Mail, someone from the Daily Mail, anyway, Victoria Bischoff article. She's saying a Money Mail investigation has discovered Britain's leading power firms are expected to introduce tariffs that charge more at peak times when they roll out new electronic smart meters. Well, I feel a bit bamboozled. I don't know about you, Anna, but because I thought these smart meters were actually supposed to be quite useful and helpful. It meant that no one had to come in and read the bill, but it turns out that they can click change tariffs using these. Another quite scary story with these so-called smart meters is that a foreign power could hack into them and cut off the entire nation's electricity supply. So how smart are these smart meters?
Well, yeah, obviously not. I think more and more the energy market is screwing over the poor it's been the case for many years that there's been less well-off properties tend to be ones that where you pay by a meter, and actually that electricity then comes at a cost which is more expensive than if you were on contract. And that's just a way of taxing the poor. And so I think, yeah, we have to look into this and make sure that we're providing alternatives.
Martin, the government is actually fining electricity companies that don't install enough smart meters. And yet it seems that these smart meters are going to be used to rip us off. Not only that, but they could be used by a foreign power to cut all of our power off.
Well, can I just mention that there's no case for this industry to be in the private sector, full stop. They were nationalised industries, and those nationalised industries were able to supply electricity or whatever it was at cost, and they're not even designed to make a profit. They're designed to just to generate enough surplus to reinvest. And we've got used to having a dysfunctional setup. So even the Labour Party and the Green Party just talk about reforming the energy companies. Mm. Those companies used to belong to us, and we used to be able to tell them what to do. For example, you can't cut off people who are, you know, sick, ill, whatever, because we won't let you. We can't do that anymore.
Yeah, I'm fully supportive of that idea. I mean, in Bristol, we are setting up an energy company. The Bristol Energy Company is launching now, you know, and that will give the people of Bristol some sort of say over an energy provider that is looking to use its profits to reinvest in improving our city as we go. So that's one step towards it. But yeah, a properly nationalised energy company would be amazing.
Well, I mean, and just to be normal practice. It's not as if we're whistling for the wind here. It's just to be what our parents and grandparents thought was logical.
And I want to come back to this thing about energy at peak times as well, because actually this is something that's facing a number of different areas in Bristol at the moment. The threat of power stations being built in St Werburgh's, in Avonmeads, in a number of different places, which are meant to be running at peak times in order to top up the energy grid, because people turn on the kettle all at the same time. you know, this it's just one other example of the fact that we're not managing our energy grid properly. You know, the government is looking at, you know, how can we get these big gas power stations in the middle of our cities, and yeah, it's not the way to go.
We also need to think about saving energy. And if you've got a nationalised energy industry, which is not there to make a profit, it can push energy saving as part of its mandate.
Martin, what argument is there then to have taken energy out of the public sector, nationalised the old SWEB it used to be around here? I mean, there were boards for right across the country. What was the argument to take it out? Well, I mean, it's done during the Thatcher era.
There's a delusion that people have that if you have more than one company in an industry, that you have some level of competition. Now, in actual fact, economics textbooks do not say that. For competition to operate, you need hundreds of suppliers in an industry, and some industries simply are not technologically, you can't have hundreds of suppliers of certain goods. It's just impossible. And I obviously welcome the energy company being set up by Bristol City Council and so on, but that is really fiddling at the edges when we really actually have to go for the jugular and say, well, hang on a minute, the case for putting these things in public ownership is overwhelming. Now, we won't get to make that case until the banks have crashed, until all the rest of it has happened, and then people suddenly say, hang on a minute, we could put a lot of this back in the public sector. It won't happen until we run into the wall, I'm afraid, because the ideological power of the neoliberal philosophy is just dominated. I mean, it's astonishing to me that they've retained ideological control of the situation despite everything that's happened since 2000.
We'll be talking a bit about media bamboozling in the second hour, but I just wonder, Anna, before we close at 6 o'clock, is what do you make of the local media around here? We've got the Bristol Post, obviously, as the local newspaper, as a daily. We've also got ITV West, we've got BBC, we've got Bristol 24/7, we've got several online news agencies. There are, you know, but I just wonder what you thought and what your experience has been about how fairly they reflect the life of the city.
Yeah, I think Bristol's media is increasingly improving and reflecting the city. You know, the cable is an amazing people's owned media outlet that is really democratic in the way that it deals with stuff, and I think it really reports the news of the city as it goes. You know, the Post is a long-standing Bristol institution that delivers news about really what does happen in the city. I think Bristol is well served by the media. I mean, the more reporting on the local life of the city that we get, the more that people are able to engage in the decisions that it makes, and that's important.
The Bristol Cable, that we haven't actually, this doesn't seem to get around the city as much as it ought to. You can certainly get lots of copies of it in and around Stokes Croft. Tell us a bit about it, and how can you get hold of it if you haven't seen a copy?
And the Cable's a member-owned organisation, so you can become a member and then you can get a copy of the Cable if you pay a monthly subscription. But you can also just pick it up from a whole load of different cafes and different places. Anybody can get involved in it. People can find out a bit more about it and offer to write for it if you want to, and report for it. It's a brilliant idea.
Martin, along with our elected representatives like Anna here, the media plays quite an important role in actually helping us survive as a democratic society, doesn't it?
It does, and I'm afraid I don't share Anna's view of the media in Bristol. I mean, the media in general is engaged in infotainment and manipulation. And of course, in Bristol, we have a strong alternative media, including our show here. But that's not enough. We need to actually get the mainstream media to actually tackle the real issues.
I remember Tim Tate used to work for Granada TV. Yorkshire TV. He was a producer there in the old style documentaries that used to really take on some of the massive issues. And he was talking about things like property porn. And this does seem to have sort of taken over in a lot of areas. Anyway, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest you heard there, Green Councillor for Easton, Anna McMullen. After the news, Paris.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.